You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Georgina Godwin, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's news agenda from a Russian perspective with author Ben Judah. Ben, what do you have for us this morning?
Kremlin joy as Putin is ranked by Forbes magazine as the world's most powerful man, a purge of the Russian Interior Ministry, and the mysterious case of saliva swabs being taken from Muslim women in the North Caucasus by the FSB.
We speak to the executive director of the United Nations Population Fund, Babatunde Osotimili, after the UNFPA releases a new report on the state of the world population.
Every day, 20,000 girls get pregnant. This is a violation of the rights of these girls because they're children. They're not in any position to be able to take decisions about getting pregnant, not the least becoming mothers.
Plus, after this week's deadly car crash in Tiananmen Square, we'll find out why Chinese authorities immediately turned to censorship.
And we'll be talking to Uta von Debschitz about the book she's produced with her brother, a lavish illustrated volume celebrating the forgotten science author Fritz Kahn as a pioneer of information graphics.
So all that, plus we'll also play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. President Obama has taken personal responsibility for sorting out the beleaguered website for his signature healthcare law, which was launched this month. The continuing problems have caused hundreds of thousands of people to lose their cover since the launch. The president told an audience in Boston that insurance companies are to blame, not his law. He says he's angry and determined to resolve the problems quickly. Google has joined the storm of protests about surveillance by the US National Security Agency. The Washington Post has published a report which claims the NSA hacked into links connecting data centers operated by Google and Yahoo. The NSA has denied having access to either company's computers. Google say they weren't aware of the alleged hacking, but that they're outraged and that there's an urgent need for reform. European Union members of Parliament have criticised reports of Americans spying on European citizens and leaders as they visited Washington for talks. The delegation has met officials from across government, including the White House, State Department, Commerce Department and intelligence agencies. Representatives of the German government have also been in Washington to discuss claims that Chancellor Angela Merkel's personal mobile phone was monitored. Timothy Kirkhope is a British MEP.
Security is the issue here. How much security and how much protection of privacy? It is always going to be a difficult balance, but in democracies and free democracies, it is something that we have to discuss and we have to settle on as politicians on behalf of the people that we represent.
The United Nations Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea has held a public hearing at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. They heard witness testimony from two North Korean refugees who described brutality they endured while being detained. Giuseppe Calandruccio of the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
The objective is not just to produce a document that will detail what is the human rights situation in DPRK. It is also and mainly the way to give to the United Nations and its organs the background information to decide what should be done to bring relief to the population of DPRK as far as the human rights are concerned.
The US has criticized Germany's export-led growth model, saying its dependence on exports is harming the global economy. The latest Treasury report says domestic demand growth in Germany has been anemic and has hampered efforts to make the Eurozone economy more stable. It said increased demand would suck in more goods from countries on the southern rim of the Eurozone, which continue to suffer from an economic crisis. The report also criticized China for significantly undervaluing its currency. But it noted that the recent appreciation of the yuan was good for the US economy and called on China to allow the currency to rise more quickly. Members of the US Congress have dedicated a bust to the former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill at a ceremony in Washington. It's described as a symbol of Churchill's service to the cause of freedom and his friendship to the United States. Among the dignitaries at the event at the U.S. Capitol building was Secretary of State John Kerry.
It was Churchill, after all, at a late-night party long past its rightful expiration date, who encountered a scold from his own party, who exclaimed in horror, "Winston, you are drunk. You are very drunk. You are very, very drunk." And Winston, without missing a beat, looked back and said, you are ugly. You are very ugly. You are very, very ugly. And what's more, tomorrow I shall be sober."
Bless him. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Very odd English accent from John Kerry.
Because the other great Churchill story, which could be apocryphal, and it was probably somebody else's, when Viscountess Astor allegedly said to him, "Sir Winston, if you were my husband, I would put poison in your tea." "Madam, if I were your husband, I would drink it."
Oh, fabulous stuff.
The Barney Show will be back in about 25 minutes. Thanks very much, Barney. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se che che che.
From London,
London. London, cara.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You are listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It is now 7 minutes past the hour. Now, every day we tell you the three big stories you should keep in mind for the rest of the day. And today we're joined in the studio by Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome to the program, Ben. Let's begin with the man himself, Vladimir Putin, shall we?
And a good day for Vladimir Putin, because Forbes magazine has ranked Russia's leader as the world's most powerful man. After years of trailing Obama and Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, as number two or number three, he's finally made it to the top spot. This is Russia typically has a problem with rankings. 140th in the Global Corruption Index, 90th in the Ease of Doing Business Index, one of the countries with the lowest male life expectancy in the developed world. But on one ranking, Putin has triumphed. The Russian press has, of course, been leading with this item and talking about how even if Russia itself has not been restored to the number two spot internationally, it's a fine day to see the president in number one. However, the main Russian business daily Vedomosti, which is co-owned by the FT, said the bad news is that Forbes described Mr. Putin as a dictator for the first time.
Well, it is all about hard power, isn't it? There's nothing soft or economic, in fact, about this list.
Well, it's about individuals. And Forbes argued, and I think correctly, which is that even though China and the US are far more powerful as states, far more powerful as societies, far more powerful creative engines of the global economy, the US shutdown illustrates that Obama does not have the same degree of influence over all the actions of the US state that Putin has over the Russian state. And similarly in China, where Xi Jinping is not able, governing with a Politburo and a party oligarchy, to affect his whims and desires as easily as Mr. Putin can translate those.
So was it more about Obama's weakness getting him onto the number one spot as opposed to Putin's strength?
Well, Putin has had a big win recently. Even though I would argue that it wasn't Russia that led to the chain of events in which the West didn't intervene in Syria, but it was rather the British Labour Party that threw a crucial spanner in the work that allowed Obama to wriggle out of it. Internationally, it's seen as if Putin stopped a US intervention.
Mm. Now, we're seeing nuclear powers of both France and Britain much further down the list than we would expect.
I think that the weakness of François Hollande comes from his incredibly low approval ratings in France. I was just looking before I came in at a poll showing that typically after 18 months in power, French presidents have had popularity ratings. François Mitterrand about 50%, Sarkozy around 26%, but Hollande's at a historically unprecedented 18%. And in Western societies where the daily opinion polls count for everything and how people see you politically as a leader, that's a big problem. And Cameron, coming back to Syria, is a man who was humbled over his Hooray Henry attempt to encourage the US to go to war.
I can imagine the photo spread in Forbes with Putin. That would be quite something, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Him shirtless wrestling lions or whatever he likes to do. Let's move on to another story, Ben. Speaking of Putin, of course, earlier this week he was joined by the IOC President Thomas Bach in Sochi, getting a bit of a tour of the Winter Games venue, seeing if the country is going to be ready for next February. But there's an interesting sideline story to this as well.
Sochi was always an odd choice for the Games because it's the only part of Russia where you don't get snow all year in the winter fully, and it's next to the Muslim North Caucasus, which has been a human rights disaster zone and a hotbed for insurgency and terrorism over the past two decades. Large chunks of it are virtually lawless, and the so-called governors are really feudal lords answerable to Putin alone, if even if. And in preparation for the Sochi Olympics, Russia is mounting a multi-directional offensive to make sure that there are no black widows at the Games. Black widows are the names of female suicide bombers that regularly strike Russia. One struck the city of Volgograd, that's a former Stalingrad, just over a week ago. And they've been going about it in quite an unnerving way. Reuters has this brilliant story in which there are reports from mountain villages that the FSB have been going around taking saliva swabs from deeply religious Muslim women that they suspect could become suicide bombers, so they can identify them afterwards.
But these groups have pledged to disrupt the Games in one form or another, haven't they?
Well, they have. I think it's an astonishing way to go about identifying potential suicide bombers, going into villages, going, "Oh, excuse me, can you show us where the can you show us where the religious women are? Oh, hello, just open wide, please, just in case you blow yourself up." It's a way, talk about ways of ethnic profiling, of ways to encourage a sense of alienation from the Russian state.
Is it really that unexpected, though, coming from Putin, who is staking so much of his presidency on these Games? They're spending $50 billion on security and arrangements for these Games, the most expensive Olympic Games ever. So if something was to happen, that would essentially destroy Putin's legacy, wouldn't it?
I'll tell you what's even more surprising, which is that St. Petersburg, Putin's hometown, has said it's interested in hosting the 2024 Summer Olympic Games, which would be a perfect way to celebrate Putin's silver jubilee, 25 years on the throne.
Let's talk about Putin firing all these top interior ministry officials, because this has been a big story there this week.
Despite Putin's success in Forbes magazine, Putin's ability to control events in Russia has been flagging in recent years. And one of the main issues he's coming up against is uncontrolled mass migration from the Caucasus and Central Asia that's piling in on the poorest parts of Moscow. A few weeks ago, you had was reported as a race riot. A race riot is when an ethnic minority riots against the police. So what actually happened was a racist riot when local whites riot against an ethnic minority. You saw over 1,000 local whites and nationalists charge a market after an ethnic Russian man was murdered, allegedly by a Caucasian. And the Russian police effectively lost control of this suburb for most of the night. Riot police came in, they're very frightened. A lot of them didn't want to engage in battles with the nationalists because they agreed with a lot of their rhetoric. Huge embarrassment for Putin that he can't even control these suburbs of Moscow. And the price has been paid with the head of the Moscow police force and the head of the Moscow investigative committee. That's the person who's supposed to be tracking these nationalist groups and other forces, have been sacked.
And I see that over 1,000 people were arrested. I mean, in any society, in any part of the world, that's going to be a huge logistical problem. Where do they put them all?
That's a false translation from the Russian for detained. They were detained and then released. So they haven't been sort of sent to prison. They're not in permanent custody.
But all of those people are migrants and people who are now being targeted by the authorities.
They are. Well, what has happened is that the Moscow authorities have set up detention camps outside the city, which Russian liberals have accused of being concentration camps, to house these arrested migrants over a series of raids that began during the Moscow mayoral elections a few months ago.
So Putin isn't really doing anything to solve the root causes of this problem.
Putin can't, because Putin is an imperialist. Putin believes in the great Soviet family, in the great Soviet space, and his mission is to reunite these countries into a Eurasian Union, which he explains would be something like the European Union. In fact, it would be something like the European Union if the European Union was excluded, it consisted exclusively of Germany and Central European countries. And his In order to do that, you can't have visas with Central Asia. You need it to be a single travel area, which means you need mass migration.
Ben, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but many thanks for coming on the program as always. Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin.
Coming up, we sit down with the executive director of the United Nations Population Fund.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin. Now, the United Nations Population Fund works in 150 countries to ensure the rights of women, men, and children. Well, on Wednesday, they released a report on the state of world population, focusing on the challenges of adolescent pregnancy.
Dr. Babatunde Osotumehin, the executive director of the UNFPA and former health minister of Nigeria, came to Midori House yesterday to discuss the report and explain more about his role internationally. He sat down with our senior editor, Sophie Grove.
The report of Motherhood in Childhood, that's the title, underscores the fact that every day 20,000 girls, adolescent girls, get pregnant around the developing world particularly, which adds to about 7.3 million in a year. Most of them are in marital unions, which means that there's a huge contribution of early marriage to this. And we like to underscore the fact that this is a violation of the rights of these girls because they're children. They're not in any position to be able to take decisions about getting pregnant, not the least becoming mothers. And it denies them of education. It denies them of access to services, including health services. It also denies them, in the long run, of attaining their full potential to be who they want to be and their self-esteem, and enable them to establish themselves as adults contributing to their communities and to their countries.
And you've been leading the UNFPA fund since 2011. You've made some quite profound structural changes and changes across the board. But give us an insight into how you've been trying to change perceptions of the age that women should be having children. I mean, it's astonishing that a lot of these women are also married. How do you go in and find the agents of change within those communities to shift the idea of marriage and the age that marriage should happen at?
You're quite correct. And as the report actually says that 90% of these girls are in marriage unions. And last year, we came out with a report on child marriages because we felt it was important to call attention to it. Now, significant is that in the countries that where this occurs, there are countries where there are laws that actually basically tell you when to get married. 18 is the age, and most of them are signed to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and they just, you know, flaunt these laws. And the impunity with which it happens is one which we need to actually advocate against. So as UNFPA, we work with communities and governments to call attention to the fact that you've signed on these laws and you must ensure that these laws are met by everybody and that impunity should not be allowed to go scot-free. I think it's trying to raise that consciousness and trying to make sure that governments do what they're supposed to do and communities also are, you know, abide by the laws because, you know, laws are there, but, you know, if communities do not go by it, and if the judicial system does not seek to account for this, then we still have a long way to go. But we're making progress, and we're seeing communities moving away from these totally odious practices.
And tell me, I mean, the report's interesting in the sense that it approaches this issue from many different perspectives, including an economic one. I mean, having so many children, having children themselves, has a detrimental effect on the economic growth of these countries. You give the example of Brazil and India really losing out on their potential as economies. Do you think that countries will look at this report and think, actually, we do need to invest more into these schemes so we can have better economic progress and more women in employment?
Yes, but I think that's part of it. I would hate to think that I only want to see girls and women from an economic perspective. But I think it's important that governments, you see that in a holistic way, individuals, girls particularly, are seen as part of a development strategy for a country. So they themselves as girls are provided opportunities to be who they want to be. But in doing so, they are also contributing to the economic and political development of their countries. And I believe that in that circumstance, we also must work with boys and men because they are part of the solution. We have to have boys see girls as equals. So gender equality must be one of the great strategies to go forward with. And men must also allow women and girls to enable them to have space to grow and to be who they should be. And we've seen in many parts of the world where this has happened, how the economies of those countries have grown because of the equal participation that we have from both sides.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I wanted to ask you about your own experience. You have been Minister of Health in Nigeria, which is the country you're from. I wondered what your own personal experience has brought to this role. I mean, Nigeria, it's such a vast country, but it also has lots of instances of women with underage pregnancies, but also violence perpetrated against them. I wondered how you've taken your experience as a minister there to the role at the UN.
I think I have come to this with different contexts, because I think that Nigeria presents such a diversity, as you have said. And there are communities in Nigeria where girls are married away early. There are communities where they get pregnant early. There are also communities which have developed, and in a sense, girls have equal opportunities as boys of their age and develop into adults and make choices in their lives. So it seemed to me that, given the diversity and the contacts I've had and the experience I've had working with communities and working in government, being able to promulgate laws and all of that is one which gives me a great advantage. But one thing I want to say, which I believe also has prepared me for this in a sense, was that before I became minister, I was also looking after the HIV program in Nigeria. I did that for 8 years. Now, in that role, we were able to work with young people in prevention of HIV transmission and prevent pregnancies. And I think it worked extremely well.
That was Babatunde Osotiminen, the Executive Director of the United Nations Population Fund, speaking to Monocle's Sophie Grove.
And welcome back to Midori House. It is 15:23 in Shanghai, 8:23 in the morning here in London, and just 4:23 in the early hours in New York City. Well, it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We're on the line now with Justin Bergman, our man in Shanghai. Welcome to the program, Justin. Let's begin with developments after this horrific terrorist. Well, they're calling it a terrorist attack now in Tiananmen Square. What's the latest on that?
They are calling it a terrorist attack today in the Chinese media, and this is what's been very interesting, I think, about how the story has shifted in the last couple days. In the immediate aftermath of the attack, the Chinese media went into hyper-censorship mode, where they were scrubbing any mention of the incident from online sources. They were directing the coverage of how it should be handled, and they're actually calling it an accident at first. And today, the news has shifted and changed, and now they're actually calling this a terrorist attack because I think this gives them, you know, it's a much easier way to control the message about what happened.
Is there any actual proof, evidence that it was a terrorist attack?
Well, you know, this is what is, I guess, going to come out in the next few days. But so far, they have linked three Uyghurs from the Xinjiang region in western China to this attack, and this has been reported by the foreign media as well. It's been said that they were the ones who drove the car into the square, and that this was a deliberate action. And you know, that's so far all we know about the motives. But the Chinese media is also now reporting that things like knives were found in the car and Islamic flags and things like that, which I think just helps them to kind of reinforce this idea that this is a terrorist attack, which any country in the world can have happen to them as well. And this helps them, I guess, in their eyes, get empathy from other parts of the world.
The Chinese government is saying that this attack was, quote, carefully planned, organized, and premeditated. Do you think that is the case, or was it more of a brash lone wolf type action?
Well, you know, with these attacks that happen in Xinjiang, it is very, very difficult to understand the true nature of the motives. The Uyghur people don't really have a spokesman outside of this one Uyghur World Congress, which weighs in on these issues from time to time. They're the ones, they're saying right now to hold off on any speculation about this. They don't want this kind of incident to be blamed as a mass uprising of the Uyghur people. So they're urging caution right now because they know that if that happens, that the types of restrictions and policing that could go on in Xinjiang would even get worse. You know, I guess you have to take everything the Chinese media reports with a grain of salt. The foreign media is also reporting largely that this has been the acts of three people and that there may be other people connected, but so far they have not reported that this is a larger issue yet.
Talking about taking the Chinese media with a pinch of salt, Chinese central television's being ridiculed over investigative reports on foreign companies. Tell us more on that story.
Yeah, this is kind of funny. CCTV, this is the Chinese central television, has been issuing reports now for the last, I mean, it's been a couple years that they've been doing this, on foreign companies and how that they're taking advantage of Chinese citizens. The latest one that they just published, which happened last week, was against Starbucks and how Starbucks coffee prices are so exorbitantly expensive in China that the Chinese consumers are being ripped off. And instead of kind of getting the outrage of Chinese citizenry, which I think is what their intent was, people online have been ridiculing this report, saying, you know, we have more pressing concerns in our lives than the price of coffee, such as the price of real estate in China, and why aren't you doing reports about that kind of thing?
Justin, what's the real aim, do you think, in your opinion, behind these moves by CCTV?
Well, the companies that they've been targeting are interesting, and it kind of gives you an idea that there is some motivation behind it. I mean, they've done reports on Apple and their customer services in China. They've done reports on Samsung. They've done reports on KFC and Haagen-Dazs. I think that there's speculation that the real intent is to drive Chinese consumer behavior in a way that they turn against these foreign companies and go toward Chinese competitors, which if that was their intent, they've done the exact opposite, because apparently, you know, sales at Starbucks are brisk as ever.
Justin, finally, let's have a brief look at fashion and what not to wear during a government austerity drive.
Yes, this is an interesting story that happened this week with the chairwoman of the state-run electricity giant who showed up at the National Women's Congress in Beijing. She was wearing a very fetching striped fur coat that elicited all kinds of outrage online. The reasons being that it shows her extravagance and her wealth, because she would dare to wear something like this to an official event. And also there were animal rights advocates who were angry she was wearing fur. But what I found most interesting was that there were some who were just plain upset by her fashion choice because she wore a very hideous striped fur coat. And some people were comparing her to a chipmunk.
Oh, that's fabulous. Justin, thank you very much indeed. Justin Bergman from Shanghai, our man there.
Now, in the next half hour of the program, we'll be meeting the urban practice manager of the World Bank Institute.
We feel that the challenge is not just conveying the technical knowledge of how to do urban planning, for example. It's also helping them understand how peers in other situations have confronted some of the conflicts.
Also on the program, he's been called the magician of popular science on the 125th birthday of Fritz Kahn. We'll find out why the world is still excited by his work. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. President Obama has taken personal responsibility for sorting out the beleaguered website for his signature healthcare law, which was launched this month. The continuing problems have caused hundreds of thousands of people to lose their cover. The president says insurance companies are to blame, not the law. Google has joined the storm of protests about surveillance by the US National Security Agency. The Washington Post says the NSA hacked into links connecting data centers operated by Google and Yahoo. Google say they're outraged and there's an urgent need for reform. The United Nations Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea has held a public hearing at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. The hearing included witness testimony from two North Korean refugees who described the brutality they endured while being detained. The US has criticized Germany's export-led growth model, saying its dependence on exports is harming the global economy. The latest report from the Treasury said domestic demand growth in Germany had been anemic and had hampered efforts to make the Eurozone economy more stable. Members of the US Congress have dedicated a bust to the former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill at a ceremony in Washington. It's described as a symbol of Churchill's service to the cause of freedom and his friendship to the United States.
Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Never have so many been grateful to so few, or whatever it is, to misquote Churchill. Thank you very much to Barney Burnham.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn and Georgina Godwin. It is 8:32 here in London. Now, over the weekend, the urbanist team were in Rabat for the second annual Atlantic Dialogues Conference, a meeting of some 300 leaders in politics, security, business and academics from around the Atlantic Basin. Well, in this week's show of the urbanists, we'll be hearing perspectives from all corners of the globe on migration, city infrastructure and transport.
In this preview, though, we meet Christine Cassidis. She's the urban practice manager for the World Bank Institute. We wanted to know why, for the bank, cities are also becoming a more important item on the agenda. Andrew Tuck asked her about their programme to train mayors and city hall employees and what the spread of best good urban practices can do.
We work in concert with our dialogues with countries and the city governments so that the World Bank's lending and policy support. And in that context, we try to understand what are the changes they're trying to bring about, what are the performance objectives they have, and what do they need to achieve that. So it's the change management process that kind of creates the need for capacity development. So, for example, many countries are going through a decentralization of political and administrative authorities to local government levels. Local governments then are getting new responsibilities that they're nowhere prepared to execute. So in a context where a government is bringing about a decentralization policy, it may be government policy, but there needs to be a training and a knowledge, making people aware of good practice experience from other places. So a lot of what we do is not to say, look, this is the way to do it, but we say, given these particular challenges you have, these are some examples of other cities in other countries that have approached it in this way or in that way. Or, you know, let's look at what their experience has been.
Are you suggesting to countries that they need to have schools and programs to bring up a generation of people who are able to plan cities and cope with this change?
We are working both at the training needs of the future generation of urban practitioners, but our particular emphasis is on the current professionals, those who are in service now and facing these enormous challenges now. So we do some training activities. In particular, we're going into e-learning because that's a way of having a much broader reach. So we're developing e-learning courses. But at the same time, we feel that the challenge is not just conveying the technical knowledge of how to do urban planning, for example. It's also helping them understand how peers in other situations have confronted some of the conflicts, how they've dealt with the debates between intergenerational uses of land, for example. So there's the sort of theory in the planning schools, but then there's the day-to-day practice, which is a lot messier, and which in developing country cities often has to deal with the fact that there's extremely rapid growth. Some of these cities are growing 4% a year, 5% a year. So it means that the sort of textbook approach to planning and urban management doesn't really work for them. So for them, they're interested in having kind of an ongoing connection with their peers through networks of local government associations, through contact with cities not only in the north but very much south-south. So we arrange a lot of what we call south-south exchange, which means among developing countries and among transition cities and so on.
That messiness you refer to, as you say, comes out of the kind of speed at which things are happening. Is it possible actually to put a plan on top of that? You look at the edges of many of these cities where informal settlements are growing rapidly without any kind of one telling them where they should be. Roads just pop up, communities develop, and the city always seems to be on the back foot, not anticipating that change. Often in denial, it seems, for a period about a settlement appearing. Again, is there a kind of mind change, even here on the ground in a place like Africa, where people have to think, actually, we need to be one step ahead of this. We need to be saying to people, yes, we know that you're going to settle this land illegally, and we're going to kind of help you. We'll tell you where to put your shack, and we'll tell you where you put your little school, and we'll kind of help engineer a kind of community for you. Mm-hmm.
It really requires an ability to have some anticipation of where the growth in the city is likely to go, but not in a master plan sense. Traditionally, a kind of an academic approach that many cities tried to do is they would occasionally, maybe every 20 years, have a master plan that would be maybe very directive, saying, you know, that there should be these kinds of shops in this area. They didn't have a capacity to implement that, and it was not able to respond to rapid change. So what works better is to really focus in on just certain kinds of anticipation of the growth of the city. For example, identifying the rights of way for the primary infrastructure transport channels, being able to identify which are the parts of the city that need to be protected as the public goods, certain green spaces that you want to protect, and plan to really carry that out, seriously protecting those areas, and trying to direct new settlement away from dangerous areas, from floodplains, for example. Now, what often happens, as you're indicating, in developing country cities, is that people come in and they create settlements, they invest themselves, and these are oftentimes in situations where the city government does not want to recognize these settlements, sometimes because they didn't fit the master plan, but often because they're ambivalent about these immigrants. They need their labor. They're providing tremendous economic vitality to the city, but governments are often very ambivalent, and they don't want to recognize them. I mean, you have everything from, like, in China, where they literally have the Hukou regulations, where if you don't have a permit, you cannot invest in the city, you can't get services. So the governments need to, first of all, acknowledge that this growth is happening. Recognize that these low-income settlements have a tremendous entrepreneurial vitality to them, but there does need to be a certain minimal direction, for example, the rights of way, so that you can lay out some public transit infrastructure before it completely gets filled in, because then it's much more expensive to do it after the fact. And then that also increases the environmental resilience of the city as well. If you don't have people living in areas that are going to be floodplains, and that's where you get some very, very serious risks in the case of storms and other natural disasters and so on.
And that was Christine Cassidy speaking to Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck for this week's Urbanist Special from the Atlantic Dialogues Conference in Rabat. You can catch the whole show tonight at 1900 hours London time.
And you are indeed listening to Midori House. After this very short break, we'll reflect on the legacy of the magician of popular science, Fritz Kahn.
With nothing more than excellence in mind, Monocle scoured the globe for the most irresistible brands, retailers, artisans, and manufacturers. Our selection highlights the very best.
A decade after jeans manufacturer Dewhurst closed its base in Wales, entrepreneur David Hyatt decided to bring denim production back to the Tevi estuary. The town's heritage means its seasoned staff share over 200 years of industry experience.
Trader's secrets revealed in our Monocle briefing film, Spotlighting Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 19:40 in Sydney. It's 17:40 in Tokyo and 8:40 in the morning here in London. Now, have you ever imagined your body is controlled by a colony of humanoids that run it like a multi-leveled factory? Have you, Georgina?
I can't say that that's what springs to mind instantly.
Well, if you have, you can thank Fritz Kahn. He's the physician and author of a plethora of popular science publications in the 1920s and 1930s.
Kahn's illustrations dramatically changed our image of ourselves. In one of his most famous works, Man as Industrial Palace, a human head appears divided into little chambers ruled by tiny men in suits. And that's now the way children are taught to think of their own body. A new Taschen book called Fritz Kahn tries to assess the importance of Kahn's legacy. We're joined on the line by Uta von Debschitz, one of its co-authors. Hi, Uta.
Hello.
The story starts for you 30 years ago, where you were travelling in America. Tell us what happened then.
Yeah, actually, I didn't know the story was already starting then. It was actually 5 years ago that we were first, my brother and I, were first confronted with images of Fritz Kahn, or from Fritz Kahn's books, actually. And we found out later that we had been in contact with his son, or been friends with his son, for the previous 25 years.
Which is extraordinary. Now, you saw those images, and instantly, after your brother had pointed them out, you knew that you had to do something with them.
Yes, that was obvious. We had never seen anything like that, and nobody else had. And until today, nobody else told me, oh, well, that's old stuff. And I immediately said, well, if there is more of that and if that really is enough for a book, let's make a book from it. And that's what happened, actually.
And Uta, what was it about these illustrations and these images that captivated you and you know, kind of inspired you to create this book?
Well, they are illustrations from a popular science book, but usually those images are, I don't know, artistically not so interesting. And these were. They really had some magic about them, and they still do. And I had never seen anything like that. They were very complex. They looked kind of naive, some of them at least. And at the same time, they seemed to be absolutely contemporary for these 1920s. They were really modernist in a way.
We were talking about Man as Industrial Palace. That's obviously one of the most iconic pieces. What others would you pick out?
Well, my personal favorite is a non-technological one, and it's called Walnut and Human Brain. It's a comparison between the anatomy of the brain and the anatomy of a walnut, and you see an open walnut and an open skull, same size, right next to each other, and it's a direct analogy, and you see that the brain has two halves and a wall in between, and there's different layers, hard layers, soft layers. And I think it's really beautiful, and it's one of those in the style of new objectivity.
And I think Georgina's brain's a bit bigger than a walnut, hopefully.
you may not be right about that.
But, you know, these images were from the 1920s, 1930s. Do you think they can still play a role in kind of giving children nowadays kind of the imagination to think of their bodies in a more unusual or unique way?
I'm not really sure about that. They were not made for children then. They were made for adults, and I think it was not so much, you know, telling you that your body is a machine, although he used that analogy. For Kahn, it was very clear that the body is not, or man is not a machine. It was just a metaphor, and it has to be sort of decoded as a metaphor, and children do that very well, but sometimes they do have difficulties, and even adults do have difficulties with that. So he was very careful with these analogies, and he always pointed out very clearly that it is just an image. It's not directly talking the truth, like you have to decode a myth.
Now, you have really rehabilitated, I suppose, his image. He's very much now in the public consciousness, particularly in Germany. You did this by your first edition of the book. You're now into a second reprinting, and also by an exhibition. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the interest was increasing. And right after we had published the book, somebody approached us and said, oh, I want an exhibition here in this Museum of Medical History in Berlin. So I did that right afterwards, and it was just a small exhibition because we didn't have much time to do it. And the interest was still increasing, so when the first edition was sold out, we decided to make a bigger one, which is twice the size of the first one. We had 200 pages in the first one, and now it's 400 pages. And we also decided to introduce more of, not only more of the illustrations, but also more of his written works, like giving examples of his texts. There is a very interesting story of a journey through your own body, which is a pattern that reoccurred in many movies or in comics, like the Numbskulls, for example. That's the kind of story that he was interested in to raise interest for your own body in his audience.
And Uta, there's also a planned tour on the horizon, I understand.
There's what?
A planned tour.
You're going to hopefully be recreating that exhibition.
Oh yeah, but that's something in the future. I'm now writing my PhD on Fritz Kahn, and when that's finished, I will think about a new project. But that's of course something that would have to be done, because people are asking for that, and there is lots of material that could be presented. So it would be a pity if that couldn't happen. But that's something that is planned for the future, really.
Well, Uta, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. It's a fantastic book. It's out on bookshelves now. It's called Fritz Kahn, Man, Machine. Uta von Debschitz, many thanks for joining us on the program.
In a moment, we'll take a look at the American newspapers. That's with our Danny Jacopelli. But first, it's time for a song. This is Malmo. That was Malmo by STRFKR.
That's a great song. Well, it's 8:50 here in London, which means it's time for us to have a flick through this morning's front pages. I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by Danny Jacopelli, our resident New Yorker, here in Studio One. But let's lead off with probably some news, which is not going to be very good news to a New Yorker.
Were you just sticking it in my face there, Phil?
I was a little bit. But I'm a Toronto Blue Jays fan, and we didn't even get into the playoffs.
Listen, I'm not going to pretend that I'm really interested in this at all, but I feel like I have to be. The Red Sox won the World Series last night. They beat the St. Louis Cardinals, and that's that, Phil.
I don't feel like I have to pretend to be interested in it, so let's move on.
Well, no, really, a lot of people in Boston are saying this is, you know, the perfect way to celebrate the city, especially in the aftermath of those horrible Boston bombings.
Yeah, and it's the first time they've won at Fenway Park in Boston since 1918, which is quite a long time. I think they're probably, it's well due, and congratulations to them. My family's full of Yankees and Mets fans, so they won't be very happy right now. But
well, let's head up to New York, shall we?
Yeah, so New York has just raised the age to buy cigarettes to 21. And this is kind of Mayor Bloomberg, who's ending his long tenure as the mayor of that city. For a decade, he's kind of been fighting to ban smoking. And, you know, as you know, he's done a lot of health policies to in that city. But it's very controversial. I mean, it takes place 6 months right after it's been signed. But, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, we could vote, we could drive, we can fight in wars, you know, but we can't smoke. And it's just kind of this bizarre thing in America where, you know, you can't do some things people consider as a vice, yet you can, you know, go die for your country.
There's still this whole debate about electronic cigarettes. I mean, I see that this age limit is also applicable for that, as is the whole what you can display in terms of tobacco on shelves.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, electronic cigarettes, that's got to be a huge blow to that industry, which is kind of selling itself as an alternative and a healthier alternative. But yeah, there we go. I mean, well, 21 in New York.
These young New Yorkers could just drive across to New Jersey and you can pick some up.
Yeah, you can drive across the
bridge. Tip for all your listeners out there in New York.
Also, Bloomberg, moving on, another story from yesterday. He wants to learn, well, he knows Spanish, but he wants to be fluent in Spanish, which is kind of a joke amongst New Yorkers because Bloomberg always claims he's very kind of Spanish savvy. He famously gave a press conference in Spanish after a big storm, and that made a parody social media account called Bloombito, which got really famous, and his broken Spanish. But I mean, the joke is here. They said, "So you're gonna use Rosetta Stone software?" And he said, "No, I'm sort of beyond that," which many New Yorkers would laugh at because he's Spanish is considered quite poor.
And of course, Rosetta Stone's the language learning tool that,
sure,
that people, even at the State Department, use, isn't it?
Exactly, which is why. let's move on to the Capitol. I mean, Barney just had a beautiful Churchill voice. I heard him do.
Do you have a Churchill voice?
No, I don't have a Churchill voice.
Oh, shame.
But it's funny here. Roger Daltrey from The Who apparently sang throughout this this ceremony. So it appears they dug up the only British person they can find in the U.S. at the time.
And it does seem very long overdue that there would be this honor for Churchill in the U.S. Capitol. Of course, even here in London, there's a statue of Ronald Reagan.
Well, sure. I mean, and Obama, President Obama, famously took out a statue of Churchill from the White House when he became president. And that was, you know, over here in the U.K., it was thought of as a sign of kind of deteriorating ties. The special relationship is gone. People related that back to his family's ancestry in Kenya, colonial ties. But, you know, here we go, Churchill in the U.S. Capitol.
And Nancy Pelosi says, in another world, he might have come here as a member of Congress.
Yeah. I don't know what party.
Exactly. Well, that would be the interesting question, wouldn't it? I really do want to hear your Churchill voice, though.
No, I'll do it after the show.
Okay.
Also in Washington, though, the GOP and Obama are polling at their personal worst, according to a new poll. Not really a big surprise. You know, the government shut down. Obama, people are saying, flubbed one of his largest domestic policy rollouts, the health care, universal health care, the website where it allows you to enroll in this, which is a major kind of disaster in his presidency. So
it is amazing just, you know, looking at American politics from the UK. You know, just 2 weeks ago, it was the Republicans that were getting hammered nonstop by the media in the press. They're saying, you know, the GOP's finished for 2014, 2016. And now it's Obama and even many Democrats saying, you know, what's going on with this president?
Yeah. I mean, his approval rating's 42% right now.
And just 29% of Americans think that their member of Congress has earned re-election. I mean, that's very worrying.
Well, I mean, Congress has lower, you know, polling numbers than, you know, viruses.
Do you think Obama is now a lame duck president? Or does he still have a bit of time, do you think?
I think he's a bit sad right now. I think he knows that it's the time's come. He's blown whatever domestic policy he wanted to pass has kind of been blown. Mm-hmm. Foreign policy wise, Syria is a disaster. I mean, they're rolling back the war in Afghanistan. Iraq has obviously kind of come to an end of some sorts. But, you know, I think he's probably not really satisfied, if I could get into his head, but I don't know what he's thinking. But
I mean, we've seen that reflected in the story we were looking at earlier today with the Forbes list of the most important people in the world. Mm. And of course, Putin came out as the most powerful, Obama down below him now because he hasn't seized that hard power that he's perceived to be in control of, all that defense spending, but no appetite to use it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the critique, leading from behind. I mean, in the long run, who knows? And we might look back and say it worked, but...
Well, maybe he would have an appetite with some spicy sauce. Not if you saw what was in it.
Moving
You'd completely
seamlessly.
Lose your appetite, wouldn't you?
Yeah, quickly, two spicy sauce stories. So
like
we've been covering this a bit. The Sriracha chili sauce in California, you know, it's a global industry based out of this city in California called Rooster Sauce. Everybody's probably seen it. Delicious red sauce. Odors are rafting through the area where it's being made. And now today, on Thursday, a judge could order the factory to stop production. It would threaten next year's supply of this chili. But, you know, that's sad enough. But yesterday, the LA Times has been reporting that 12% of all spices imported into the U.S. is contaminated with insects, animal excrement, rodent hair, and even rubber bands. 12% of all spices that you put on is crap.
I think rodent hair is the worst.
I mean, that is atrocious.
What about you, G?
Well, rubber bands, you'd had to notice,
You'd notice that, right?
Wouldn't you?
Well, I assume it's dried and crushed up. It's probably not like actual rubber band sitting in your, like, you know, cardamom.
They don't say which spices in particular. This is across the board.
No, it came with a big photo of mounds of delicious-looking spices, but this is across the board.
Ginger and poppy seed, black pepper and red pepper, and allspice.
There we go.
This is not something I want to pursue. Really?
Well, Danny, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for. Really enjoyed your spicy stories, as always. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denny, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Maddie Arujo, and our studio manager was Alex Funnel. Up next, after the news, is Culture with Robert Bound. And, of course, stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London, 7 o'clock in the morning in New York. And, of course, I'll be back with Marcus Hippie for Midori House at the same time tomorrow.
And I'll be back in an hour for the Continental Shift. But now, from me, Georgina Godwin.
And me, Phil Hahn. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.